This is lecture number 6 on the Book of Shmos, delivered at the Jewish Center on Sunday, December the 16th. Chapter 3, verse 11. All right, up until this point, we find that there is a dialogue between the Ribbono Shel Olam and Moshe about the question of the shlichus, the mission that Moses is commanded to undertake. Now, here we find something similar to what happened to Abraham, to Jeremiah, to Isaiah, to all others. And that is, when the prophet receives his first charge from the Ribbono Shel Olam, his immediate reaction is to protest. He doesn't want it. Look what we have here. In verse 10, the Ribbono Shel Olam says to him, you have it on page 4, now then go, I'll send thee unto Pharaoh and bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. This is, of course, the appointment of Moses as the messenger of God. And Moses said unto God, the immediate reaction, Mi anochi ki elechab, who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt? It's a protest. He doesn't feel himself worthy. He doesn't want to do it. Abraham says, Matiten livanochi holach aridi. How am I going to do this sort of thing? Jeremiah says, Omar aha kinar anochi. I'm a child. How do I come to prophecy? Isaiah says, Ki tmeis vasayim anochi. Vesoch am tmeis vasayim anochi yoshev. I'm a man of unclean lips and I dwell amongst the people of unclean lips. How can I prophesy to them and how are they ready to accept the prophecy? The first reaction of a prophet is always this introversion, this saying, it's impossible for me to undertake such a fantastic task. Then after receiving the assurance of God, all doubts are wiped away. Then the prophet has enough courage, has so much certainty and confidence in his mission, that his courage becomes exemplary, so that he's able to risk his life without a second thought thereafter, because he is so certain of the nature of the message that has come to him. But the first reaction is always one of self-doubt. So what does Moses say here? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should take the children out of Egypt? What does God answer him? Vayomer ki eheye imach, and he said, because I will be with you. Vizelach ha'os, and this is shall be to you the sign or the token, ki anochi shalachticha, that I have sent you. When you take the people out of Egypt, you will serve God on this mountain. Now, there are three ways of interpreting this disclaimer by Moses. The first one is general fear. Who am I to go to Pharaoh? After all, what am I? I'm only a small man. I'm only a shepherd. You want me to go to a shepherd representing a slave people, a subjugated collection of tribes? How am I going to go to Pharaoh and talk to him this kind of language? This is a general fear, general humility, the general humility or modesty of the prophet. And the answer is, don't be so modest, I'm not sending you, I'm going. In other words, God says to him, I'm not saying that you're going to go under your own steam, under your own power. You're not going to go and win this battle by the force of your own personality. You are essentially the kli, the vessel of God. Therefore, don't worry so much. I'm going with you. Ki eheye imach. I'm going to be with you, and therefore you needn't worry. And this is for you, the sign that I sent you. What is the sign? No. V'zelach ha'os p'yanoch chinoch shlachticha. This will be for you the token, the burning bush. The burning bush will be the token. You're only a bush. You're only modest. And you're going to be beset by the flames of Pharaoh, the flames of international intrigue, and yet you will not be consumed. This will be your sign that you're going to survive, because I sent you, and therefore you're going to survive. That's one interpretation. The other one is a rather fancy one that Abarbanel mentions, and that is, it almost sounds like an American Zionist as opposed to Ben-Gurion Zionist speaking to the Ribbono Shel Olam, that he says to them, look, Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm afraid. I'm afraid of Pharaoh. I'm a criminal, after all. I'm an escapee. What is the word? Someone has been accused. A fugitive. I'm a fugitive from Egyptian justice. The Egyptians know that I that I am guilty of some terrible crime of disloyalty and treason, and they're out to kill me. So first of all, Pharaoh is looking for my life. And then implied in this is V'chi otzi es b'nei Yisrael mi Mitzrayim, means why should I take the children of Israel out of Egypt? If you want to be good to them and you want to make it easy for them, then why take them out? Leave them in Egypt and make it good for them there. They've been accustomed to live here for some 200 years, is it? Or more that they're in Egypt. Why do you want to uproot them now? After all, they're used to it. They know the language, they know the customs, and they are essentially Egyptians of Mosaic persuasion. To use a 19th century anachronism, like the German Jews said. It was a very good question. And as we can be good Zionists, we can still remain in Egypt. We love you, God, but we love Egypt as well. So why take them out of here? So that there are two problems that Moses presents. If you look carefully, Vayomer Elohim, Mi Anochi, V'chi Eilecha Paro is one thing, V'chi Osi Es B'nei Yisrael. First, why do you send me to Pharaoh? I'm a fugitive. I'm afraid of him. He's looking for me specifically. Second, why go through this fantastic plan of taking a people out of this country when they already live here? Leave them here and try to bring them the Yeshua, the salvation, whilst they are in Egypt. So God answers two things. First, about your fear, ki ayem och, don't worry. And second, about your plan of remaining in Egypt and just lightening their burden, v'zeloch ha'os. This will be a token, this will be a sign, ki anochi shelachticha. What is he saying? This will be the sign that I am speaking to you. The sign that, in other words, you will be able to survive a trip through the desert. And b'hotziyacha es'am mi'mitzrayim, you ask me, why shouldn't I leave the people in Egypt? Why do I want to take them out of Egypt and into a strange land? The answer is this. B'hotziyacha es'am mi'mitzrayim, tavdim es'alehem ha'har hazeh. I am taking them out of Egypt not because this is the only way I can lighten their burdens of servitude, but rather it has a higher purpose, and that is for Kabbalah Satorah. You see? So when in other words, when Moses in his first part says, how will I go? He says, don't worry. I'm going to be with you, and as a sign that I'm going to be with you, here is the proof that I'm sending you, so I will be with you. Finish. The second question, Mi anochi ki otzi es bnei Yisrael me'arev Mitzrayim, why should I take them out of Egypt? Why not let them here? To this he answers, God answers, well, the reason for my taking them out is not freedom alone, not political freedom alone. It's something bigger than that. It's because on this very mountain you're going to worship God. I want to take you out for a higher spiritual destiny. This is the answer. And that spiritual destiny cannot take place besoch gelulei Mitzrayim, amongst all the idolatries and abominations of Egypt. So for that you'll have to have a complete extrication from Egypt itself. Barbanel himself gives another explanation, which is quite interesting. Look carefully at what God tells him. One second. In verse 8, Pasuk Ches, God says, "Ve'ered lahatzilo mi'mitzrayim." I'm going to go to save Egypt, save Israel from Egypt. U'la'aloso min ha'aretz ahi. And to take Israel out, right? Two things. First is to save Israel, and second is to bring them out, and bring them where? Bring them out of Egypt, El Mekom HaKanani, to the land of Canaan. Then what does he say to him? In verse 10, that's in verse 8, in verse 10, God says to Moshe, now come, I will send you to Pharaoh, V'hotzei es am livnei Yisrael mi'mitzrayim, and take Israel out of Egypt. Did he say that he's going to bring him into Eretz Israel? No. Nothing at all. So Moses begins to complain. Why do you want me to have the job, the difficult job of taking the Jews out of Egypt that you give to me? And the nachas of bringing them there that you don't want to give me? You see? Moses detected in the words of the Rabbanu Shalom that something was wrong. He gave him two tasks. That one task was the Hatzilo, to take him out of Egypt, and the other one was the Haloso, looking at the Mekom HaKanani Yechidei Amori, to bring them into the promised land. And what does God tell me, says Moses? Take him out. Why not bring them there? Factually, Moses didn't. Moses had only the job of taking them out of Egypt. The task of bringing them into Mitzrayim, he had to leave to his successor, to Yahushua. So Moses began to complain. He says, some job you're giving me. And that's why he says, Mi anochi ki elecha paro v'chi yotzi b'nei Yisrael mi'mitzrayim. Why do you want me to do that? Why should I be the one to take them out of Egypt if I'm not going to have the pleasure of fulfillment of bringing them into the promised land. So God says to him, it's enough that you have this token that I am sending you. When you take the Jews out of Egypt, it'll be for Matan Torah, which is an even greater accomplishment than bringing them into Eretz Israel. He says, and you want to have the nachas, don't ask for it. It's sufficient for you the reward of being a messenger of the Rabbanu Shel Olam, of having the gift of Nevuah. The special nachas of being a political leader to see them to fulfillment, that's asking too much. Don't ask for rewards, Moshe. Enough that I am sending you. Yes, but it's interesting how Abarbanel detects it in the indirectly, implicitly, in the words here, that at the very beginning, God already did not tell Moses, you're going to bring them into Egypt. The words of the Torah, now that we know the end of the story, imply the very same idea. Let's look at Rashi for a moment. The words ki ehaya imbach in verse 12. Rashi says, "Hey shivo arishon rishon v'alachar anachron," that God answers on the first and the last. When he said ki mi anochi ki elachar paro, who am I to go to Pharaoh? So what did God answer him? Lo shel chahi ki emishali. It's not you who's going; it's I am going. In other words, you're not going qua Moses; you are going only as a representative of God. And proof, the vision at the burning bush, which is a sign that I sent you and that you're not going on your own. Ki anochi shlachticha, that I sent you, and therefore I will take care of you. And the second one, you see, the second one that Moses says, ki otzi es b'nei Yisrael Mitzrayim, Rashi interprets differently. The Agada interprets that, how do I know that Israel is worthy of being saved? Moses, don't forget, was a man who was very disappointed in his people. At the very story that happened several decades before this, why is Moses now in exile in the desert of Midian? Because of the Jew, that's right, because of the Hebrew who complained. And don't forget, according to the Agada, this was a devastating thing for Moses. Here he's coming out of the house of Pharaoh to help his fellow Jews, and the same one he saved is Dustin Ravina, the very same person whom he had saved from the Egyptian, the next day threatens to turn him in because he reproaches him. Yes, it's a masa, it's a holshana, it's an informer. So that Moses is terribly distraught because of the perfidy of his own people. And he does not feel that this people is worthy of being redeemed. Therefore, he says, how do I know that I should take them out? Maybe they don't deserve it. Maybe they're not ready for it. So to this, God answers, the answer is that they are worthy not because of their past record, but because of a future event. What is that? That they are going to receive the Torah on this mountain. So I am taking them out of Egypt because they are going to receive the Torah on this mountain. Interestingly, what does this imply? This Rashi already is a hint for a later interpretation by somebody else. Do you recall of the Pesach Seder? Yes. We say, when it comes to matzah, we say, Bavur zeh osa Hashem li betzeisim mitzrayim. What does that mean? Why do we eat the matzah? The Torah says, but we should tell v'yamata labincha bayomahu, Bavur zeh osa li Hashem, or osa Hashem li. How is it, Mr. Julius? Osa li Hashem, or osa Hashem li betzeisim mitzrayim. Asa Hashem leave and say to Mitzrayim, we can rely upon a Valkriya. Because of this did God do unto me when I left Egypt. What does that mean? Actually, the matzah is a symbol that we left Egypt. Shouldn't it be reversed? That Ba'avur, Aneo says, Ba'avur Shehashem Hussi Osi Mitzrayim. What do we say the reverse? We say that Ba'avur Zeh, because of the matzah, God took us out of Egypt. Ibn Ezra says just it. The whole Yetzias Mitzrayim was because of the matzah. We generally interpret it reversed. The matzah is simply a historical recollection of Egypt. Ibn Ezra is a very profound philosophical point. Ibn Ezra says that God took us out of Egypt because of the matzah. The matzah isn't so much a symbol of Egypt as it's a symbol of worship of the Rabbanu Shalom, a symbol of our faith in God, because of the fact that we took it on our shoulders and we walked out. We abandoned the world and relied only upon the Shekhinah. This itself is the symbol, in other words, the matzah. Bavur Zeh is a symbol of Jewish loyalty to God, and that was why Jews were taken out of Egypt. This is what Rashi says and is basically implied in the pasuk itself. Why? You say they're not worthy of it. They are worthy because later they're going to serve God on this mountain. That is the reason for Yetzias Mitzrayim.
Also, isn't it that the least saying to Moses, who do you think you are that you're such a big shot that you can make decisions? Don't forget, I am the Lord thy God, and therefore it is up to me to decide whether these people should be taken out or not.
See, yes, but,
Moses,
you know.
He's saying to the Rebbeinu Shimon, who am I? You see, and then God says to him, but you shouldn't ask that whether, you shouldn't question whether you're the man for the job or not. The fact that I chose you.
Yeah, that's established. But the second part you question, according to Rashi, what Moses does here is two things. He has personal and collective humility. First, who am I? Second, who are they? So the answer is, who am I? Don't worry, it's not you, it's me.
But when it comes to who are they, he can't question.
But he does, and evidently he's right. And evidently he's right. The rabbis say that Jews were not worthy of redemption, except for three things, that they didn't assimilate completely. Otherwise, they were memtesh shaaretum. In other words, they were sunk in the same paganisms of Egypt.
That's true, but we still don't know the overall plan what Rebbeinu Shalom has for us as a people.
But we did, in this case, we did know it, because there was a promise to Abraham that would be redeemed at the end of a certain number of years.
Have you ever done, like with the matzah, it has some meaning for the future, there's some goal.
Yes, in other words, this redemption, God tells Moses, this redemption from Egypt was not because they were worthy of being redeemed as a result of their behavior, but rather because of their destiny. It's not history, but destiny that dictated this redemption.
Yeah.
All right? Kasuto says that the Zelacha Ha'os, that this is the sign, refers to, he reads as follows. Interesting, this is a very important verse. Vayomer ki yeyemach, he said, because I will be with you. Now, the Zelacha Ha'os ki yenecha shalachticha, this is the sign that I have sent you. Until now we have read, this is the sign that you should go to Pharaoh because I sent you. Kasuto says, no, we read it all together. V'zelecha ha'oz ki anochi shalachticha. This will be the proof that I sent you. How will anyone know that I sent you? The answer is, b'otziach ha'asam mi'mitzrayim. When you take the people out of Egypt, going to the land of the Canaanite, you ordinarily would not pass through this point. You would ordinarily go a direct route. The proof will be that you're going to go around and on this very mountain, which is so far out of the way, a 40 years journey, that you're going to stop at this very place, and that will be the vindication of this prophecy. That will be the oath. You see? Yes, except for the fact that there's an asnachta after shalachticha. If you read the top, the tamim, the notes, v'zelachos kinachi shalachticha, semicolon. Oh, well, the other interpretations fit in very nicely, because Moses asked two questions. He gets two answers. You see? In this one case, I can't go along completely with Kasuto.
Yeah.
Because...
What would be the other thing?
Oh, the other one is, number one, you want to know, who are you? Well, it's not you, it's me. And proof of the fact that I'm sending... Proof of the fact that it's not you who is going as an individual, by your own authority, is ki anochi shlachticha, that I am sending you. Therefore, you need not ask, who am I? It's not you, it's me. And furthermore, when you ask about Israel, don't worry.
And the token is what? Is simply
the fact that I'm speaking to you out of the sneh.
Oh, this is me.
Yes.
But I think this is not contradictory at all. Both people.
Yeah.
Yes. The sign that I send you, you have what? But this could be any use. This could be a singular situation. You will also get the incoming call.
Yeah.
You wait for it.
You mean you agree with Kasuto?
No, Kasuto does not contradict the other. I say Kasuto is essential.
Yes.
I think the other make a point. Kasuto makes the point which is essential. The whole second point, meaning the second part of the point.
Yes. Bahut Siyaka. Kasuto,
has meaning unless it has a meaning in the mission.
But it does have a meaning. You see, even without the...
Well, if you give the first explanation,
that's right.
There is no house, because
Oh, no, no, but they finished the O's, you see? Moses, if you look in verse 11, there are two keys. Each one represents a different problem. There are two problems that Moses presents to God, for which he gets two answers, according to the Abba and other commentators. One answer is, the second answer is, the first question about yourself, well, this is the sign I'm sending you. The second question about Israel, whether they are worthy or whether you'll bring them in, however you want to interpret it, the answer there is that they are coming out of Egypt because of the reason to receive the Torah. You see, this basically makes more sense in the structural aspect of the question and answer. Kasuto has two questions and only one answer. And that's not good. It doesn't make sense. Rashi's traditional answer makes more sense because it has two answers for two questions. No. Unless you want to say, the only way I can justify Kasuto is as follows. If you look at verse 12, Vayomer, and he said, Ki yehi emach, I will be with you, that answers the first question. Yeah. The second question. However, it's not too clear because it just doesn't balance. And the Esmachta, again, is in the wrong place. The Esmachta is the musical tone under the tuff of Shalach Ticha. That's a semicolon, basically.
Yeah, but the semicolon has also, remember last time we pointed out, there are two, the story is repeated twice. This whole dialogue is covered.
Yeah.
And then double meaning.
I'm not quite willing to read the double meaning as much as you are. You see, when it came to the Joseph story, I was willing to go along.
No,
here I haven't quite established the double story. Yes, well, that's just it. All right, if you wish, yeah, he'll be later on to be a vindication. All right. Yeah, he's discussed with them after this recent incident.
He
of course. He's a real rabbi. he works and says, I can't accomplish anything, I'll throw my hands up. He's going to sell mutual funds. Yes. Not all.
No, he has reformed it.
Yes.
He has accepted everything they had. But he has even accepted.
Of course.
Because
he purified it, naturally.
Yeah. And this must be contained somewhere.
The whole idea that they're going to worship here is really the answer. I think Rashi has a profound insight. The Vechi Otzi, that I should take them out, does not refer so much that I should take them out, but that I should take them out of Egypt. What's the purpose of the whole thing? You see, Moses is asking, what's the purpose of taking them out? What's going on? Why?
Yeah.
Rashi, of course, puts it in a Gadic form. Maybe they can be here. He elaborates, let them worship God. Let them be free in Egypt.
Yeah.
Whether you go for it or not, the idea is essentially there. Why do you want to take these people out of it? Who are they? Why are they not ready for anything of the sort? The answer is they have a historical mission on this mountain.
That's right.
See, and that makes very much sense.
But I also question when it came to Abraham, we had a situation as the Akedah, which was the final test of Abraham's faith in God. What actually have we seen so far that shows us that Moses has a belief in God? What test has he been given?
Oh, look, the test for Moses goes throughout his life. This is just the first incident. Abraham's first incident was
in a series of situations which Moses has to be exposed to in order to
precisely
prove his faith in God. This is again what I'm saying in the very beginning. What God says to him that when he's trying, I don't know Hebrew.
Yeah,
so I mean,
go ahead, read the English.
But from the English interpretation, again, I get the feeling that God is testing him, and therefore Moses cannot.
No. This is not a test. See, this refusal of a prophet to undertake the mission is not a matter of a lack of faith in God. It's a matter of a lack of faith in himself.
Of course.
See, he says, Miyamoki, who am I?
If you have faith in yourself, then therefore you have faith in God, and therefore...
Not necessarily.
Well,
people have so much faith in themselves, sometimes they have no faith in God.
I mean, let me, about the church and the rabbis, well, why is it all worth it? You know, maybe I should go out and sell mutual funds.
But don't take me too seriously.
I mean, this goes on, let's face it. I mean, the idea, it may come into your mind from time to time, and then you, again, the reason why a rabbi or an individual...
Well, let's talk about Moses. He wanted to be, he was happy as a shepherd. He says, why are you bothering me, God?
Sure, all right. Why are you bothering me, God? But then, in order to keep his faith with the people, if he still believed in God, accepted God, and realized what his mission was,
yes.
Then he realized he had to go ahead and...
Except for one thing, Trudy, no prophet is a piece of passive or plastic clay. Every prophet, and this is the thing we forget, although the prophet essentially is a mouthpiece of God, at the same time, the prophet has personality. I know I'm right. He has personality. And there is always an interplay between the subjective character of the prophet, his own soul, and the overwhelming hashpah, the overwhelming influence of the divine that comes down upon him. Heschel's new book speaks about this in great length, the one just published by the JPS, The Prophets, which is basically a translation of his German Die Prophetie with a lot of additional material. There is an interplay that can't be denied. Now, basically, the objective message always comes through, but it always comes through filtered by the prophet's own personality. That's why the rabbi said that Ein Shnei Neviim Misnabim B'Signon Echad. No two prophets prophecy in the same style, because the style c'est l'homme, as the French say, the style is the man, and each one was a different kind of man. Now each prophet must react to the divine charge. It's not a matter of a lack of faith. You may ask me to do something, if you have full faith that your faith is just. I doubt, however, my own ability to do it. Well, let's go further now.
Does Moses understand the last
part of this phrase? Surely. No reason why not. It's obvious. It's pshat. Whether this service will mean a matter of the great revelation?
That's what I'm saying.
Yes, it's unimportant though. God, however, tells him that a great event will take place on this mountain.
He doesn't know what.
Well, an act of serving God, some kind of confrontation between man and God. Yes.
A man who doesn't want the job of taking the people of Israel out of Egypt, does he understand what's to befall him upon Sinai?
You mean the...
man at this point is a historical role in world history.
Yeah.
I would say that he does. It's a historical point because Moses agrees, you see. If you come to the next point, you find that he had complained about Pharaoh, he complained about the Egyptians, And then he comes to complain about the Jews. Not complain, but he asks God further. Now, assuming that I'm going to do this, he says, I'm going to do this because there's a great role in store for me. To know that exactly which Ten Commandments he's going to receive or what Torah, this is irrelevant. But he knows that he's destined for something great. These words have meaning to him.
Well, I'm looking at it from a human point of view. This is a man.
So?
He doesn't want this job. Does he realize what the job is?
See, but not wanting this job, Marty, not wanting this job is not in the same way as, let's say, I'm asking you to serve on a youth committee. This not wanting the job is a matter of meeting up with a destiny and still trying to shrink from it. And the moment God... Obviously, look, the whole scene of the Sneh Bor Be'esh and having God speak to him. And you'll see the next few sentences when God identifies himself in the form that he does. You see that this is obviously some kind of supernatural experience. It isn't merely a meeting of two equals. Now, Vayomer, verse 13, Vayomer Moshe Elokim, and Moses says to God, Hine Anochi Va B'nei Yisrael. This is good and well. I'm going to come to the children of Israel. In other words, until now I've talked to you about Pharaoh and Egypt, and you said you're going to be with me and everything is all right. Now let me talk about my people. Let's say I'm going to come to them, and I'm going to say to them, the Elokei Avoseichem Shlachani Lechem, the God of your ancestors has sent me to you. What's going to happen? They very naturally and correctly, Viyamruli, they're going to say to me, Mashmo, what's his name? This God you speak of, what is his name? Ma'omaro, and what should I tell them? I'll come back to this in a minute. And what does he say? Vayomer Elokim Moshe, and Elokim said to Moses, Ehye Asher Ehye. You translate that several ways. I am that I am, I will be what I will be. This is the identification he gives the name. Ehye Asher Ehye. Literally it means I will be, Asher, that, or who. Ehye, I will be. Vayomer, and God continues to say, Kosom Alevnei Yisrael, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, Ehye, Shluchani Efanechem, Ehye sent me to you. Before it was Ehye, Asher Ehye, now it's Ehye. Vayomer Od Elokim O Moshe, God again says to Moses, the third statement now, right? The third Vayomer. Kosom Alevnei Yisrael, thus shall you say to the children of Israel, Hashem, Yudkei Vavkei, the God of Abraham, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, Shlachani Lechem sent me to you. This is my name, La'olam, forever. V'zeh zichri, this is my memory, L'dor v'dor, from generation to generation. These two verses are fantastically important. Let me try to analyze only a trifle of what their meaning is. First, the question of a name should not be looked upon and lightly. Kasuta points out that in the ancient Near East, name was terribly significant. The name identified the content. Name was regarded as a clue to essence. That's why a person was named not merely for a dead grandparent, but name was always mentioned. Somehow the parent tried to influence the destiny or define the essence of a child or the circumstances of his birth by a name. Adam calls names to all the animals. The names reflect the essence, the function of the animal. Name always is meaningful in Hebrew. It's not merely a tag that someone gives in place of a number in a more highly technical society. It always indicates something deeper. Now, let's read Rashi. We're going to go to a series of different kinds of interpretations. Verse 14, Vayomer Elokim Moshe, God says to Moshe, Ehye Asher Ehye. Rashi got lost someplace here. 1 minute. Oh, here it is. Now this is the Agadic interpretation of Ehye Asher Ehye. Agadic and extremely beautiful. He says, Ehye Asher Ehye. Rashi says, Ehye Imam B'tzara Zos, I will be with them in this tzara, in this affliction, B'shiabud, Asher Ehye Imam B'shiabud Shar Malchios, as I will be with them in further tzaras. What God says, just as I am going to, Ehye Asher Ehye, in other words, is what? It's the promise which will be followed by fulfillment of God's presence, commiseration with Israel. Ehye Asher Ehye means let them know that I will be with them in future subjugations as I am with them in this subjugation. I will be them in future exiles as I am with them in the present exile. So Ehye Asher Ehye means the knowledge of the Jew that God is always with us, which means that the Golos and the Geula of Egypt, the exile and redemption of Egypt, is paradigmatic. It's a lesson for all future history of Israel, that just as God is with us in this occasion, he will be with us in all other occasions. So then what happens? This is the first statement. The second Vayomer, the second statement of God, does it include Ehye Asher Ehye or not? What then is it? Only one Ehye. Right? So Rashi explains as follows. When God said, Ehye Asher Ehye, tell them that just as I am going to be with them in this shibud, in this tzara, I will be with them in future tzaras. So Omar Lafonav, so Moses said to him, Rabbona Shalom, Ma'ani maskilahem tzara acheres, dayim b'tzara zu. He said, they're being subjugated so terribly now, I should mention them tzaras later on too. Enough one tzara, he says. Which is a very commonsensical point of view. He says, look, God is telling me the whole story of future history, that just as I am with them in this terrible predicament, I'll be with them in future terrible predicaments. He says, don't tell them about future terrible predicaments, they're going to give up completely. Die on the tzara zu, enough one tzara at a time. That's why, so God says to him, Yafa Amar, it's a very well put, from the human point of view, you understand it. Therefore, don't say Ehye Asher Ehye to the children of Israel, but this is the way you shall say, Ehye, I will be with them in this tzara. Forget the future tzaras. You see? Which is a very beautiful Agadic interpretation of the whole thing. Yes. Don't tell them about later tzaras or not.
American person.
Yes.
Wrote a terrible book about this Egyptian experience for Moses, because he said Moses was there and matter of fact he doubted the existence of God. Terrible atheism.
Well, we're not responsible for
guessing.
You
read it, because
yes. No. Now, there's another interpretation. There are several other interpretations. The question, Mashmo, what is his name? What should I say to them? Is interpreted by the Rambam, by Maimonides, and the guy for the perplexed, as being a request for two things. Number one, Moses wants God to give him some manner of proving his existence. He says, these people don't know of you. They may have a faint historical memory, but they don't know, and I have got to give them some kind of proof. Amitas mitziyuso, to a verification of your existence. Second, I've got to give them a verification of the fact not only that you exist, but that you communicated with me. So ma omar aleihem. So therefore, Maimonides goes into an answer, eya, shir eya, and I can't explain it too much now because it's quite difficult. Basically, what, according to Maimonides in his philosophical and rationalistic interpretation of Chumash, says that what God answers Moses, eya, shir eya, I am that I am, means that I am the one being in the world whose essence and existence are not separate. In other words, all other beings, their essence, what they really are, and the fact that they exist are two separate things. Theodore Roosevelt is dead. His essence is one thing. His existence is no longer, does he any longer exist? No, but the essence does exist. The essence and the existence are two separate things. With God, essence and existence are identifiable, which means God is eternal. The fact of his existence and the quality of his essence are the same thing. God is pure being. So therefore, who am I, you ask? What should I say to them? Say to them, I am pure being. Eya shir eya, I am eternal. A similar answer is given by Sa'ad Yagon, who says, without this philosophical sophistication of the Rambam, who says that eya shir eya means I was and I will be. Just as I was, just as I am, so I will be. In other words, I never ceased to be in the past. I never was created. I am an uncreated creator. I always was, and I always shall be. Basically, Sadia takes the beautiful agad of Eya Shrei, Bitzara Zu, and Bitzara Acheras, and gives it a more philosophical interpretation, the eternity of God. The Medrash had a similar idea, when the Medrash points out that you have three times the word Eya. Eya Asher, Eya. And then the second part, Eheye Shlachami, three times. Because three times Eheye for three tenses, past, present, and future. Rashbam, who is, although a Franco-German scholar, nevertheless the first-rate Pashtun, which means the primary meaning of the text, says that what is the word Eheye, and then how does it come to the name of God that we have, Yud Kei Vav Kei, the four letters, Yud, and then Ahei, Vav, and Ahei. What does that mean? What is the pronunciation? We pronounce the word Adonai. Actually, that's not the pronunciation at all. But what is the relation between Ehiyah and that?
The three
Very simple. Very simple. The word Hoveh means being. Means being.
Hoveh.
But this is the idea. The word Hoveh means being itself. Being itself. Now, when God speaks of his being, he uses the first person singular, Ehyeh.
Yeah.
When we speak of him, we say Yihyeh. He is. But instead of Yihyeh, we use the Vav instead of the Yud to give the impression not only he will be, but this totality of being. God is the essence of being itself. So the name Yud Kei Vav Kei that we always use is simply our way of speaking of God. When God first reveals that name, he speaks in the first person. Thereafter, he himself speaks of himself in the third person. You follow? Eheyeh is God's way of saying his name. I will be. We say he will be. Or he is. God says I will be. Or I am. Eheyeh is simply the same thing as Hashem. Except this is third person, this is first person. Furthermore, Rashbam points out very, very correctly, in Hebrew there are no three tenses, there are only two tenses. And what we call future tense is essentially present or unending. In Hebrew, there are two tenses. What we call past means, grammarians, how was it called again? The perfect tense, an action that has already ceased. an action that has already ceased, and an action that has not ceased. What we call a future is an action that hasn't ceased, and what we call a past is an action that has ceased. When you say yihyeh or ehyeh, it means I am and will be, of course. As there, it means the concept I am in English, let's say, in Western grammar, means present, but not future necessarily. In Hebrew, present implies future, as future implies present. It means a continuous action. Havoya masmedes, continuous being. So according to the Rashbam, ehyeh means I am eternal. Who sent you? The eternal God, not a God who is ephemeral and temporary. Now, Kasuto points out, and we'll see later. Sure. For instance, let's say emloch, to rule. Malachti and emloch. The word malachti means I ruled and then I was thrown off my throne. The word emloch means I rule. And I will rule. I am in a state of a sovereignty, of ruling, of rulership.
Yes.
In primeval Hebrew, there is no such thing. Original Hebrew has only two tenses. The introduction of three tenses is basically lifted from the Arabic grammarians through the Jewish grammarians.
Yeah, but let's say when Shmuel says to Shaul, you will rule over Israel.
Yeah.
What will he say?
Timloch.
Yes.
Yeah. There's not. No, there. You see, what Rashbam is saying, and this is pointed out by all modern philologists, that the present and future is. There's no distinction in early Hebrew.
Yeah.
Later Hebrew distinguishes, of course, very clearly. But early Hebrew has no distinction. And you find it throughout the Torah as well. That,
the
Rav HaHibur is something else. That's past and future. Sure. It's a concept of time that's involved. We really don't have a present participle. The verb to be does not exist in Hebrew. The verb to be, how do you say to be in Hebrew? No such thing. How do you say I am a man? Ani ish, I man. The present participle is always absent. Why? Because it's meaningless. I equals man. It's an identity. An identity does not require the copulative verb. I didn't present, I mean the copulative verb. It doesn't require the copulative verb because what does it mean? It's only an identity that you're making. The idea to be, as a matter of fact, refers only to God. Only to God. Yihyeh with a vav instead of a yud. He is. No one else really is. Because present is basically ephemeral. You know, it's this moment, it's only an imaginary line. Present is only an imaginary line. On one side is past, the other side is future, and the line keeps on moving. So it itself is only imaginary. So the Semitic language, especially Hebrew, does not have that present tense in its fullness as we normally imagine it.
We don't have the verb shall and will. Usually the future is connoted by shall and will. Tomorrow
yes.
I shall do this. Tomorrow.
Oh, we have in Hebrew, but in Hebrew you can also use it for the present. That's the whole point. The borderline is very vague. Surely. I would rather keep off this conversation for 10 minutes. I'll tell you why. Because we're coming to the problem of here a metaphysical understanding that even Moses had. Even Moses had here, no matter what you say, has a higher philosophical connotation. You can be as historical as you want and say we're dealing with a primitive people, all the zibbenglicken. But the fact is the words have high philosophic content. And we'll see in a moment that God himself, when he talks to Moses, switches over. Hold on for a minute. Hold on for a minute. Let me come now to... Kasuta points out something, incidentally, that Abarbanel... Kasuta has taken many things from the traditional interpreters and without quoting their names. It's a remarkable thing. If you want to follow Kasuta, who is the most modern of Bible commentators, if you learn through all of the Mefarshim, you find that 90% is there before. which is incidentally not a criticism of Kasuto, but a validation of Kasuto, a great deal of what he said. He says that verse 14 is the explanation and verse 15 is the name. Vayomer Elokim Moshe Eya Asher Eya, I will be who I will be, and Eheya, I am Eheya who sent me. This is the explanation of verse 15, the name Kosar Melbene Yisrael Hashem. This word Hashem is explained in the previous verse. All right. Abarbanel says the same thing. Now what does Abarbanel say? I hope I'll be able to finish it in the time that's left to us, because it's rather fascinating, the explanation that he gives. He said, don't forget that we're living in a certain milieu. Prophecy is not a phenomenon peculiar to Israel. Great prophecy, monotheistic prophecy, is peculiar to Israel. Ethical prophecy is peculiar to Israel. But the phenomenon of prophecy is also tied into superstition and black magic. You had soothsayers, you had witches, you had the Ovidoni, all kinds of religious hysterics who were marching up and down the land and used to fall into trances and become hysterical or whatever it is, and in these trances they used to speak words of prophecy. The idea of prophecy as being the result of a certain kind of ecstatic experience is a pagan phenomenon as well as a monotheistic phenomenon. So what Moses wanted to know was, number one, if I'm going to go to these people and say that I'm a prophet of God, they're going to say to me, I'm a prophet, they're going to say, good, you're a prophet. A prophet of whom? Because we have them by the dozens. They walk up and down the streets of Goshen, and they tell us, I'm the prophet of this star, I'm the prophet of Jupiter, I'm the prophet of Venus, I'm the prophet of the moon, I'm the prophet of an angel. All right, which deity is it who sent you here? Which is a perfectly legitimate question if you consider the historical milieu. Second, Moses says, I know that you sent me, God. I'm a monotheist. I mean, I know exactly what's going on. I'm Moshe. But I want to know, what level of prophecy do I have? You see, there are two questions. First, Mashmo Mo'omar Aleim, what will I tell them? Secondly, Moses understands immediately that there are various levels of prophecy, even from the Ribono Shel Olam. Maimonides, don't forget, in the second part of the guide counts 11 categories of prophecy, and each of them very carefully marked off. Moses, how did he have his initial revelation? Through the burning bush. And it was a malach elokim mitoch asna, an angel which spoke to him. So he says to the angel, to God in other words, directly, he says, what is my level of prophecy? Is it through an angel? Through what level? Because an angel means that it's not the highest kind of prophecy. Therefore God answers him and says, no angels. It's a direct prophecy. Moses from this moment on has no intermediates. Moses' prophecy, as Maimonides points out, is the highest prophecy imaginable. It comes, as the rabbi said, ba'asklaparia ha-me'ira, not ba'aspaklaria she'en ha-me'ira. The other prophets got it through a dim light, a reflected light. Their prophecy was through a trance, a dream, an angel, a voice, a vision, a puzzle, a riddle. Moses always had a direct message, and this starts in this moment. So that God, he asked God these two questions, and what does he answer? He answers, Eheyah. I want you to know that the message comes from God, not from Chalila, a mazel, not from what do you call a mazel in English? A constellation? Or a star? Avodas Kochavim? Doesn't come from an angel. It comes directly from me. Now, what does this name mean, Eheyah? Abarbanel also gives a philosophical interpretation, but one that's quite interesting. He calls it, using Maimonidean language, Mechuyav HaMetzias, absolute being, which means this: all other existence, all other things that exist, have relative existence or dependent existence. My existence, after all, depends upon my heart, my lungs, and so on and so forth. The existence of this table depends upon the wood, the quality of the wood, its rigidity, its fireproof, waterproof, and so on. In the course of time, as a result of the wear and tear of the elements and the fervent prayer of people sitting on this side of the table, this table will be worn away and destroyed. Everything that exists is only temporary. Why? Because their existence further depends upon something else. But God, Eheyah, my existence, my being, Asher Eheyah, depends upon myself and nothing external. Therefore, my being is completely independent and absolute. Now, do you follow what I mean by absolute being? My being is not dependent upon some other quality or some other existent. E-X-I-S-T-A-N-T, or existing thing. My existence depends upon my existence. Therefore, my existence is eternal. It's God is absolute being as opposed to the relative being of all other things that are. Relative ultimately to what? What are other things relative to? To God. Relative to God's existence. If there were unimaginably kaviyochel no God, there would be no being. Therefore, God's being is absolute, all other beings are relative. Eheye asher eheye, I am because I am. I depend solely upon myself, upon no other being. This is a long explanation. Once you know this idea, this mystery, this idea, then it's sufficient to say the word eheye, right? That's enough. So listen how Abarbanel interprets it. Moses asked him for these two things. Number one, what will I tell them? Number two, I want to know. So God says, Eheye Asher Eheye. This answers both questions. And it gives the explanation of Mechuyav HaMetzius, God whose being is absolutely necessary and dependent solely upon himself. Then, Bayomer, now that I've told you who I am, you can tell this to the children of Israel, Kosam of Israel, Eheye Shlachan Eilechem. Eheye meaning, explain to them the whole idea. The word Eheye is meaningful. Furthermore, will they understand it? It's a question. Vayomer od Elohim al Moshe, God continues to say, they may not understand it, so kol somer at b'nei Yisrael. This is how you should say, Hashem, and if they don't understand who Hashem is, Elokei Avoseichem, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yisrael, Elokei Yaakov, then don't go with them into metaphysics, into theology. Simply say, this is your traditional God, who is the cause of this Golus. How is he the cause of this Golus? He's the God of Abraham, to whom he said he put you in Golus, the God of Yitzchak, with whose birth, the beginning of exile is counted, the 400 years, and the God of Jacob, who came actually down into Egypt. Each one of these has a different word. Elokei Avram, Elokei Yisrael, Elokei Yaakov. Each of these is important to the determination of the exile. One to whom it was announced, the second with whom it begins, the third who actually came here. He sent me to you, and this God will redeem you. So there are two concepts that he gives to Israel. One, a high philosophical concept, Eheye. The other one, traditional historical concept, not even a concept, but personality. Who? The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And look how beautifully Abarbanel says it. Zeshmi le'olam. This is my name. Which one? Eheye asher eheye is my name le'olam, for the world. Forever. It determines being. Le'olam means forever. What is forever? Time concept. What is eheye asher eheye? Existence or a time concept. This is my name for eternity. Eheye asher eheye. But insofar as the dor dor for generations, for the historical knowledge, the dor dor is a historical concept. Zeh Zichri refers to Elokei Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov. There are the two names that he gave him. So Zeh Shmi Le'olam refers to Eheye Asher Eheye. Zeh Zichri, the dor dor, refers not only to Le'olam, not for the eternity, not for the philosophic time concept, but for every generation. A generation wants to be redeemed. It has existential problems. The existential aspect refers to the historical traditional. Zeh Zichri Le'dor Dor, this is my memory. How do you mention me? The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Yes. And further, this falls into line with the whole traditional concept of Zeh Shmi Le'olam. What is wrong with the spelling of Le'olam here?
The vav.
A vav is missing. So the traditional explanation, the famous Talmudic explanation is, if you read it without a vav, without the nekudah that we know as Le'olam, how would you read it? Le'olam. Le'olam means, what does the word ayin lamed mem mean in Hebrew? The root? To hide, to cover over. Lo sucha lehis alein. Lehis alein means to cover your eyes. Zeshmi, this name of Havaya, Yudke Vavke, is Le'olam. Should not be pronounced. Because this name has high theological or theosophical significance. This name of God is Le'olam. How do we read the name Yudke Vavke?
Adonai.
And this is not the real pronunciation, is it? Look how the name is pronounced. The name Yud Kei Vav Kei, in the same verse. Or the next verse. Under the Yud, there's a Shva. After the Hey, there's a Cholam. And under the Vav, there's a Kamatz. What does this mean? That the English has Jehovah, right? This is ridiculous, you know. First of all, in English, in Hebrew, there's no J sound. Second, even if the European, even original Hebrew, there's no V sound. It's a W. In original Hebrew, the V that we have is a Germanic influence. Actually, it should be W, as the Arabic Jews do today, the Iraqi Jews. They don't say Hovevi'iyah, they say Hoveviyah. They don't say Mitzvah, they say Miswa. So, that's ridiculous. But what does it mean? Why do we have these Nekudos there, do you know? Why do we have a Shva, Cholam, and Kamatz? We simply take the vowels of the word Adonai and apply it to Yud Kei Vav Kei. Under the Aleph, what do you have? Achatav Pasach. The Pasach is not original. It's really a Shva. Why do you have a Chatav? Because you can't pronounce an Aleph with a Shva. So you put a Chatav Pasach, a Pasach with a Shva. Really, it's Kama, it's Shva, then Do is O, and then R. You do the same thing over here. So you have Yud with a Shva, a He with a Cholam, and a Kamas. So the Jehovah is ridiculous, because the only reason we use these things in the printed Chumash is because we take the Adonai, which is the name we use for Yud Kei Vav Kei, and apply the vowels here, but otherwise it's meaningless. What they do modern days, Y-A-H-W-E-H is even more ridiculous, because the whole construction isn't the Hebrew construction. What is the pronunciation? We don't know. It was known to the high priests of the first and second temple, who used to pronounce it aloud only on Yom Kippur. You know the avod that we have on Yom Kippur? That he used to announce the Shem HaMephorah, Shem HaNichbad HaGadol. That's the one time a year when the Kohen Gadol will bless the people and announce the Shem HaMephorah. The explicit name. And even then they were afraid it would fall into wrong hands, so the young Kohanim used to sing loudly so no one else could hear it. And then in the course of time it was lost. We don't know anymore the real pronunciation of the name. That's Zesh Mi La'olam. Indicating by our pronunciation that the secret that God gave to Moses is basically a secret. It's a mystery. We only can have the barest insight into the concept of God's omnipresence, His being all the time present and everywhere present. As the Rambam writes in the Moreh Nevuchim, after all is said and done, we have proof. In other words, logically we can understand that God is separate from the world. Logically we can understand that God is every place. How do you combine these? That remains a mystery. That remains a mystery.
You mean the true name of the Rabboni Shalom?
We don't know. No.
Well, where did we get the names often?
Well, that's an English word. We refer to them as Adonai too, or Hashem or the Kim.
Yeah.
But the proper name of God, the pronunciation of Yud Kei Vav Kei, that we don't know. And therefore, we even say Yud Kei Vav Kei. That's where we say Hashem. Even the names we do know, we don't pronounce because of the simple rule that familiarity breeds contempt. Which, incidentally, is also one of the reasons we can't touch a Sefer Torah. I don't know if you realize it. The inside of a Sefer Torah, this is the Sefer Torah, right?
Yeah.
The inside, you must not touch with your hands. When you come and make a bracha, you kiss it with your talus. The reader has a pointer.
Yeah.
You may not touch it with your fingers. So much so, if you do touch it with your fingers, you know what the law is? It contaminates your hands. You have to wash your hands. To teach you to keep away from it. Why must you keep away from it? Because of respect. If you keep on touching it, you're too familiar. There's also another explanation that Gemara gives, but this itself makes sense in this context as well. All right.
The Shekhinah, huh? The Shekhinah is everywhere.